This is a sermon given by A.F. Ballinger at the General Conference session in 1893, Tuesday, February the 21st. The title is The Persecutions in Tennessee. And the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. The time is not far distant when we will not all gather here to listen to the story of persecution. We will not have time. However, I have been requested to narrate the recent persecutions in Tennessee and trust that their narration will be of one interest and profit to us all. The story is short, but there are some incidences connected with the recent trials that are interesting, and I will refer to them briefly. By way of introduction, I will briefly narrate the history of the persecutions in Tennessee. Some of you have not been in this country and therefore have not been posted with references to these persecutions. Again, it will serve to show that they are not ephemeral, something that has sprung up to continue for a day or two, but that they are a studied and continued effort to persecute the remnant people of God. As early as 1886, we have the imprisonment of William Dortch, the father of William Dortch, who was on trial at this term of the court. W.H. Parker and James Stem. These three brethren were incarcerated in the parish jail for 2 months in the summer of 1886. Our camp meeting was held at Paris the same year, and the sheriff accompanied the brethren from the jail every morning to the campground, stayed with them in the same seat through the services, and at night returned them to the jail. Elders Farnsworth spoke one Sunday evening on the subject of the United States in prophecy, and when he came to the point where this government was to become a persecuting power, he pointed to these three men before him in the custody of the sheriff. And it made a deep impression, not only upon our people, but strangers were affected. And even the sheriff himself sat there and wept during the discourse. Following this, we have the case of Brother R.M. King, which I think began in the year 1889. He was first brought before the magistrate and fined $3 in costs, amounting to $12.85 for doing farm work on Sunday. This fine he paid. He was then indicted before the grand jury in Oban County for working upon this same Sunday and other Sundays. The case was tried, and he was found guilty and fined $75 in costs. The case was then appealed to the Supreme Court of the state of Tennessee, and the decision was there affirmed. The case was next appealed to the United States Circuit Court, and again the decision of the lower courts was sustained. The case was next appealed to the United States Court, and it was on the docket when Brother King died, thus bringing the case to an end. During the time the case was being tried in the courts, there was little or no persecution as the people were awaiting the results of this case. But when it was finally learned that the United States Circuit Court had decided against him and that he had died before the United States Supreme Court could review the decision of the lower courts, persecution began again. I might, however, notice the connection of the churches of Tennessee with this case of persecution. When the case came before the Supreme Court of the state of Tennessee, the prosecuting attorney failed to appear and was telegraphed for, but he failed to come. The governor of the state was telegraphed that the case was pending. The ministerial Association of the City of Memphis, Tennessee, hearing of this, hastily called a meeting and passed resolutions at that meeting to employ counsel to prosecute Brother King. There seems to me to be a providence in the death of our brother, and I might note it here. If the case had gone before the Supreme Court of the United States and had been decided against us, those who were longing to prosecute us would have seen in it the endorsement of the federal court and would have brought the severest persecutions upon us, not only in Tennessee, but elsewhere. But Brother King's death brought the case to an end. And we have since learned by decisions of the United States Supreme Court what would have been the action of that court had they reviewed the case. We have therefore saved the money that we would have invested in an appeal, and we have also saved persecutions that would have doubtless followed if the case had been decided against us at that time. Following this, four more of our brethren, this time in Henry County, were indicted. They were J.H. Dorch, J. Moon, S.M. Laurie, James Stem, and W.D. Ward. The first four were convicted. They employed no lawyers, believing it was of no use, and believing the scriptures where the Lord promised to speak through his people when they are brought before magistrates. They appeared for themselves, and they were convicted, refusing to pay their fines. They were placed in the prison there at Paris. The people soon got tired of boarding them in the Paris jail, and so an effort was made to work them, and finally an old, obsolete law was resurrected by which they discovered that the Paris jail was a county workhouse. Then our brethren were placed in the chain gang and worked, but only for a few days, as their time had nearly expired. I think three of them were in jail over the Sabbath, and an effort was made to work them on the Sabbath, and a resolution to that effect passed the board, but the sheriff refused to act in the matter. He said, "Gentlemen, if you undertake to work these men on Saturday, I will have nothing whatever to do with the matter." And his earnest effort in their behalf saved them from the experience of an attempt to force them to work on the Sabbath. They were then told that it would go harder with them if they persisted, and so, when they came to trial this time, not only the jail and chain gang stared them in the face, but also the possibility that the severest punishment might be inflicted to compel them to work on the Sabbath, but they did not flinch. It was my privilege to attend the Institute in Springfield, Tennessee, just before these brethren came to trial, and to witness their confidence in the Lord. I have seen them get up in the midst of a discourse and stop the speaker and say, quote, "I know now what religious liberty really is, and with this liberty which I now enjoy, I can be just as free inside the parish jail as I can at home with my family," close quote. During the time that intervened between the trials of the brethren, the last persecutions, and these recent arrests, the National Religious Liberty Association sent from its office more than 300,000 pages of literature to the state of Tennessee, direct to ministers. Almost an equal amount has been shipped to Tennessee and distributed by other methods. After the Springville meeting, those of our brethren who did not go out to canvass in distant parts of the state mounted their horses, filled their saddlebags with religious liberty literature, and went all over that county, leaving this literature and these pamphlets in the homes of the people. Paris was also canvassed just before the trial. Every lawyer in Tennessee has had due process of law and divine right of dissent. Religious intolerance in the Republic. Every newspaper in Tennessee has had the tract in the chain gang for conscience sake. These are the names of the tracts. Due Process of Law and Divine Right of the Dissent. Another track. Religious Intolerance in the Republic. Every Baptist minister in Tennessee has had the same. Every Lutheran minister, every Unitarian minister has had the same matter. And I believe it has had a great effect. Voice. Did not the Attorney General ask them if they had been affected by the literature that had been distributed in Tennessee? Yes, they questioned the witnesses and also the jury on that point. Not only did they attempt to get the men this time, but they attempted to indict women and ask the boys who were before the grand jury whether they had seen their sisters or mothers working on Sunday. The prosecuting attorney said that they proposed to arrest every man, woman, and child of the Seventh-day Adventist if it became necessary in order to put a stop to this work on Sunday. I read you now a copy of the indictment. Quote, State of Tennessee, Henry County, Circuit Court, September Term, A.D. 1892. The grand juries of the state of Tennessee elected, impaneled, sworn, and charged to inquire of and for the body of the county of Henry in the state aforesaid upon their oath find that Billy Dorch, late of said county, labored heretofore to wit on the 18th day of September 1892, that day being Sunday, and divers other Sundays next before that date, and up to the taking of this inquisition, in the county of Henry aforesaid, then and there, unlawfully, openly, publicly, notoriously, and unnecessarily did engage in his secular business, and did perform and follow his common avocations of life on Sundays, by working on the farm, plowing, harrowing, hoeing, pulling fodder, and doing various and diverse other kinds of work on Sundays, said work not being necessary or a matter of charity, and it was and it is to the great annoyance and disturbance of the people, to the evil example of society, prejudicial to public morals, and a public nuisance to the citizens of the county, and against the peace and dignity of the state. J.W. Lewis, Attorney General. Still quoting, and the grand jury aforesaid, upon their oaths aforesaid, do further present that Billy Dorch, on the day and dates aforesaid, in the state and county aforesaid, and in the manner and form aforesaid, was guilty of a nuisance by said workings on Sundays to the prejudice of society and against the peace and dignity of the state. J.W. Lewis, Attorney General, close quote. The following persons were indicted in accordance with this indictment just read: William Dorch, T.F. Dorch, J.H. Dorch, W.D. Ward, S.W. Lowry, James Stem, Drew Fitch, Bowman, Finch, J. Finch, Joe Parker, Wilson, Frank Stem, Moon, no name attached, Jim Parker, and many other parties whose names to the jury are unknown. Brother Piffany and I arrived at Paris at 4 o'clock Monday afternoon and met Mr. J.T. Ringgold of Baltimore and our indicted brethren at the 10 o'clock train and introduced Mr. Ringgold to them. A local reporter telegraphed through the county that 300 Seventh-day Adventists have arrived from Wisconsin, Michigan, and Illinois and were swarming the hotels and courtroom waiting for the trials of their brethren. We gathered in a room in the hotel to talk over the situation, and Mr. Ringgold was surprised to find the brethren so perfectly willing to go to jail or into the chain gang if this proved to be the result of their trials. Afterwards, he remarked to me, I have never had clients before who were willing that I should win or lose their cases, who were perfectly satisfied to have their cases go either for or against them. We explained to Mr. Ringgold that we had decided to employ no more lawyers in the cases, but had hoped that the Lord would put it into the heart of some lawyers to interest himself in these persecutions, in which case the work would be done from a love of the principle involved and not from mercenary motives. We frankly told him that we believed that the Lord was using him in this way, and while he, in his humility, disclaimed such an exalted mission, he expressed himself anxious to defend our brethren to the best of his ability. Voice, how did it happen to do that? It came about in this way. He wrote a book on the subject of Sunday laws and came out on the right side of the question. Brother Tate learned that such a book was published and wrote to Mr. Ringgold for a copy. And that was the commencement of the interest that Mr. Ringgold has maintained toward the Seventh-day Adventist and of their interest in him. When he learned of the recent persecutions, he offered to plead their case without charge. Mr. Ringgold requested us to engage a local attorney to aid him in the peculiar law practice of Tennessee. So we employed Mr. W.L. Carter of the place, who, while Justice of the Peace, refused to hear Sunday cases against the Seventh-day Adventist. It was discovered by our lawyers that great carelessness had been exercised in drawing up the legal papers in connection with indictments against our brethren. And all but two of our brethren escaped on technicalities, that is, the indictments were quashed. Let me give you an idea of the way the law-abiding citizens of Tennessee undertook to persecute Seventh-day Adventists, whom they declare are a lawless people. The order of the grand jury was to prosecute W.D. Ward. Instead of this, this indictment was made against W.G. Ward. Again, J.F. Finch was indicted, while the order for prosecution was Finch. Again, J.A. Wilson was indicted, but the order for arrest called Wilson. And on this order to prosecute Wilson, J.A. Wilson and Charles Wilson were arrested. Then under the expression, many other parties whose names to the jury are unknown, Harry Ward and Rufus Ward were arrested. Under this method of wholesale indictment, the way was opened, as Mr. Ringgold remarked to the court, for the prosecution to throw out a dragnet and haul in the whole county. But this was according to the order of the grand jury, which said to His Honor Judge W. H. Swigert, we feel that the said parties should be prosecuted. Yet in view of this order for wholesale prosecution, the grand jury themselves said, no one will appear as prosecutor, and therefore the judge was asked to appoint a prosecutor. No one spoke against them, save concerning the law of their God, and no witness was found to testify against them. So they were subpoenaed against W.D. Ward as witnesses, his sons Rufus and Harry, and these sons had against them J.F. Finch, Tom Ward, and their father, and were summoned as witnesses against each other. J.A. Finch had against him Rufus Ward, Harry Ward, James Finch, and Leah Finch. John Wilson had against him W.C. Laurie, his two sons, Otto and Charles, and Joe Parker. I might mention right here that Rufus Ward, one of the defendants, and who appeared as a witness in several of the cases but a few months ago, was a wild boy caring nothing for any day working or playing on any day he chose, but as soon as he became a member of the Springfield Church, he was indicted. Billy Dorch had against him, when he came to trial, his brother J.H. Dorch, his little son Ambrose Dorch, 10 years old, and his neighbor's boys, Jack Converse and Willie Hastings, besides Joe Parker and Frank Stem. The two later were, however, absent. When the cases came to trial, the courtroom was packed with spectators. For several days previous, a murder trial had been in progress, but it was noticeable that it did not create near the interest that these trials of our brethren did. At the last trial before this, the prosecution had prepared for a fight, and when they discovered that our brethren had no counsel, the wind was completely taken out of their sails. It was a severe shock to them. But at this trial, they did not expect that our brethren would appear with counsel, and hence the indictments were drawn up recklessly. But our attorneys put on their legal spectacles and discovered that the indictments were worthless. This was another great shock to the prosecution. Then, of course, they thought, we have no friends. But there sat behind our counsel ex-Senator Toley and ex-Governor Porter. The prosecuting attorney was very much depressed when he found that ex-Governor Porter was against him, as he is one of his warmest political friends. Boys, how did the governor happen to be there? Well, we had invited ex-Senator Toley to be present and witness with his own eyes the trials of our brethren. He had been very much interested in these cases and has read the Sentinel for 4 years. The Sentinel was sent to him when he was in the Senate, and after his term expired, he subscribed for it, and in a letter just received from him, he says he cannot get along without it. On his arrival at Paris, he called on his old political friend, ex-Governor Porter, and told him of the trials just about to come off. As a result of this conversation, the governor declared his willingness to appear for the defendants without remuneration. When the case of William Dork came up for trial, among the witnesses who went up to be sworn was little Ambrose Dork, only 10 years old. The judge spied him out and asked the prosecuting attorney if that little boy had been summoned as a witness. The attorney, who evidently had not expected so many distinguished spectators to witness these medieval persecutions, appeared ashamed and said he did not care to have him be sworn, that he could step aside. Mr. Ringgold and Mr. Carter arose and stated that he was summoned as a witness, to which Mr. Lewis made no reply. Silence was golden. The little boy took his seat, inasmuch as the prosecuting attorney had no use for him. Two of the neighbor's boys were put on the stand and testified to having seen the defendant working in his garden on Sunday. Brother William Dork is a singing teacher. These men had gone to the church to find him there, but not finding him, they rode down to his house, where they found him at work in his garden. The boys had probably unintentionally mentioned the fact to others, and from this were forced unwillingly to testify against their neighbor. These two were the only witnesses outside of the Seventh-day Adventist Church whom the state brought against our people. A rather amusing incident occurred during the questioning of the witnesses by the prosecution. The attorney questioned with the view of bringing out the fact that the work was done near a church on Sunday. Mr. Ringgold, who was listening intently, heard a low remark by the witness and immediately interrupted with the query, "You said that was near a church, didn't you?" "Yes." "Well, what church was it?" "Well, it was the Seventh-day Adventist Church." Turning to the judge, Mr. Ringgold remarked, "I wish simply to bring out the fact, Your Honor, that it was our church near which the defendant was working." The next witness was John Dork, brother of the defendant. He testified to having seen him pile chunks in his back field. And by the way, not a man on trial lived on the public road, and their farms could be reached only by means of private roads. When the prosecuting attorney discovered that he could make no case against the defendant, he called for Ambrose Dorch, the little boy, again. After questioning him regarding the nature of an oath, the judge said he would regard him incompetent to testify and that he might stand aside. The little fellow, who, by the way, was bright and smiling, stepped back and took a seat on his uncle's knee. This incident had the effect to bring out the true persecuting nature of these prosecutions as nothing else could. Think of a child being ordered by the state to testify that the work of his father disturbed him to the extent of constituting a public nuisance. The witnesses having been disposed of, the speech of the prosecution was in order. You understand that the prosecution has the opening and closing speeches. The prosecuting attorney, however, remarked to the judge that he had nothing to say, that the case might go to the counsel for the defendants. Mr. Ringel then presented a series of reports to the judge for instruction to the jury and was followed by Mr. Carter. Mr. Carter made a very pertinent allusion to the real spirit of the case, that is, with reference to the point of disturbance. He said, "These men have disturbed no man by their work. No man has been found to testify to a disturbance. My friend here, the Attorney General, has his horse hitched up and is driven to the station on Sunday, and it disturbs no one. And even His Honor, when he came to this place to hold court, remained at home with his family until the last moment and then took the train on Sunday. It was not held as a disturbance to anyone." At this point, the judge was seen to wince a little. Notwithstanding all this, the prosecuting attorney made a frantic effort to convict these men. He undertook to grow eloquent about the morality of the people of Tennessee and how the Sabbath must be maintained and that according to Holy Writ, etc. But when he struck Holy Writ, Mr. Ringel was on his feet in an instant and said, "Your Honor, I object. Holy Writ does not come into this case. It is a civil trial, and these men are indicted for a civil offense." The judge sustained the objection. And for the first time in the history of the trials of our people in Tennessee, the cases were removed from a religious to a civil basis. At the close of the attorney's appeal, court adjourned for 1 hour for dinner. Immediately after the judge's charge to the jury, after court had again convened, and before the jury had left their seats, the prosecuting attorney arose and remarked, "If Your Honor please, the state confesses a verdict of not guilty." The judge immediately remarked, "Gentlemen of the jury, with your consent, I will enter a verdict of not guilty." The jury nodded assent, and the trial of William Dortch was at an end. He was too late, however, in confessing a verdict of not guilty, for the spectators plainly saw that he exhausted all his sources of evidence in the attempt to convict. I might mention one interesting point with reference to these cases. Inasmuch as all but two of the witnesses were Seventh-day Adventists, they will draw out of the county funds for witness fees about $85. Mr. Ringel, in commenting upon this feature at the dinner table in the presence of a number of lawyers and others, remarked that the people of Tennessee ought to be indicted as a nuisance for furnishing money in this way to the Seventh-day Adventists for the support of their work. Before passing further, I will say that the case of Tony Dork was postponed till the next term of court. The prosecuting attorney, knowing that this case would go as the others had if it came to trial at that time, and realizing that the whole community was looking to him to sustain the Tennessee Sabbath, pleaded a continuance. He claimed that he had witnesses by whom he could prove the point of disturbance. It was shown to him and to the court by Mr. Carter and Mr. Ringel that these very witnesses were members of our church, and that it was not at all probable that he could prove his point, but as there was the merest hope that he could win the case by securing additional evidence, and as he strongly desired the postponement, the judge granted a continuance. To show you that there is a division of opinion in Tennessee touching these persecutions, I will here read two newspaper extracts. The first is from an editorial in the News Banner of Troy, Tennessee. Quote, Henry County, in Judge Swigger's jurisdiction, has an enormous nest of Seventh-day Adventists in it. The grand jury has indicted 11 men for plowing, hoeing, and hauling on Sunday, in other words, following their ordinary occupation on Sunday. In nearly every case, these Adventists are as bullheaded as they are ignorant. A large, rich, and well-organized band of Northern Sunday lawbreakers are at the heels of these ignorant Henry County people, egging and hissing them on, also furnishing them money. All this is done under the guise that religious liberty is assailed in Tennessee. This organized band of Northern agitators claim to be far ahead of the rest of the world in understanding what constitutes civil and religious liberty. They send out thousands of pamphlets each week and send them broadcast all over the United States. The substance of all their statements in printing is that there ought to be no national or state observance of Sunday, and that it is a cruel, barbarous, outrageous violation of a national religion and civil rights to prevent a man from working on Sunday. If they had their way and Sunday blotted out, we think Christianity would be subverted. Many newspapers, North and South, have been tricked into defending these Advent rascals. Not only are they guilty of blasphemy worse than devilish, but they are worse than the foul-mouthed Antichrist who believe in the total disruption and annihilation of all law. The law of Tennessee specifically and definitely says you must not work on Sunday. Yet these infamous anarchists, lawbreakers advise people to override the law, ignore their state statutes, defy their courts, and set up their own private and individual preferences as against the system of society under which they live. Judge Swigert will forfeit his right to respect and esteem of his judicial district if he does not visit the extreme penalty of the law on these grand rascals who thus with undashed boldness flaunt defiance in the teeth of our judicial system. A severe and terrible lesson ought to be given them so that those who have in mind to break the law might be deterred. But these ignorant Henry County people are more deluded than bad. The real criminals, the propagandists or sowers of bad seed that need hanging, are the pamphleteers known as the National Religious Liberty Associations. The truth is, the works and the fruits of this anarchic association show that it is a cunning, a deep-laid scheme to do away with all religion and the law and all society. Judge Swigert must either penitentiary or hang these Henry County men or make them obey the law, and if he ever catches any of the members of the National Religious Association in Tennessee, he should either hang or penitentiary said Liberty Association men. Close quote. Here is the other side. It is but fair to state that there are good people in Tennessee who love liberty, and this is not by any means the sentiment of all the people of Tennessee. Here is an interview with ex-Governor Porter, which appeared in several of the leading dailies of the South. Quote, My consent to take part in defending these cases is not based upon any sympathy with the peculiar tenets of the denomination to which these defendants belong, but is simply due to my desire to vindicate the rights and liberties of all citizens of our state. I believe that the action of our courts with reference to this question of compulsory Sunday idleness has hitherto been in contravention of the principles of American liberty, as well as contrary to the express provision of the Constitution of our state, according to my construction of it in regard to religious equality, and I am gratified to have the opportunity of doing what I can to reverse that action in the interest of humanity and of true liberty as I understand it. I've always understood that these people are peaceable and law-abiding citizens, and I have yet to learn that the acts for which they are indicted have injured or incommoded their fellow citizens in any way or interfered in the slightest with any substantial rights of others. Regarding them as I do, as the representatives of a great principle, apart altogether from the religious aspect of their belief or their conduct, I have no hesitancy in saying that I sincerely hope that they will successfully emerge from their present legal difficulty. Close quote. I will also read you portions of an interview with Mr. Ringgold, in which also appears in several Southern papers. I read from the Nashville American of February 3rd, quote, Mr. Ringgold said, I suppose you want me to tell you how I came to be here and what I expect to do. I have taken considerable interest for a number of years in the Sunday law question, and through a work on that subject which I recently wrote, I became acquainted with the National Liberty Association, which I found to be composed largely of Seventh-day Adventists. As the association and myself had a warm joint interest in the cause of religious liberty, we have ever since been in correspondence. While I learned of the proceedings against the Seventh-day Adventists in this country, which are similar to those to which our Hebrew fellow citizens are occasionally subjected to in Maryland, I at once wrote to the Secretary of the National Religious Liberty Association stating that if I could be of any service whatever in defending these men, it would give me pleasure to volunteer my time and labor in the good cause. My proposition was accepted, and that is how I happened to be on the ground. You will understand, therefore, that my concern in the matter is by no means that of mere counsel, but that of a citizen who believes that there is an issue at stake in all such cases as these, irrespective altogether of their results, so far as the individuals are concerned. While this idea I have persuaded my friends to allow me every legal resource in their favor, having associated myself with Mr. W. L. Carter of your bar. I understand from what you tell me, Mr. Ringgold, that you are not yourself a member of the Seventh-day Adventist denomination. No, I am not. I am a communicant in the Episcopal Church, but while my denomination has special religious services on Sunday, just as it has been on Christmas Day, Ash Wednesday, Good Friday, Ascension Day, the 40 days of Lent, and on many saints' days, I am not aware of anything in its doctrine or discipline which either requires or justifies the use of the police power of the state to compel anyone, either within or outside its pale, to observe a different line of conduct which he observes on any other day. This being the case, I understand that I am as free to advocate the absolute equality of all religions and of no religion before the civil law as is a Seventh-day Adventist. This is the cause in which I am so deeply interested, and this interest is the cause of my being in Paris at the present. I want to state also that to my interest in the principle at stake, there has of late been added a daily increasing personal interest in my clients. I have been for some time past studying the peculiar doctrines of the Seventh-day Adventists, as well as making acquaintances among them, and I do not hesitate to say that I regard them as the most remarkable and interesting set of people in the United States today. I have been fairly astounded by the combination which I find in them of intense zeal and absolute toleration. They have given the lie to the philosophy of all ages, which has always been agreed upon, the proposition that toleration can only coexist with indifference. And they have done more than this. They have elevated toleration from a mild virtue of self-control to the position of a leading and fundamental Christian duty. Incredible as it may sound, they believe in and act upon the theory that there can be no true religion without the absolute divorcement of religious and civil influences. This is a doctrine which has never before been enunciated since it was first given to the world by the founder of Christianity. That is to say, never officially enunciated by any organizations so far at least as I am aware. There is another thing about these people which connects them remarkably with the Christians of the first era and distinguishes them as sharply as well as anything could from the average Christian of these days. This is their willingness to suffer for opinion's sake. Perhaps this contributes even more than their orderly, clean, and upright manner of life to make them valuable citizens just now. They are history makers just as were the first Christian martyrs. It was by bringing out the rancor and cruelty of the Roman government that the Christians destroyed pagans' intolerance. It can only be through such men as these Seventh-day Adventists that in the inhumanity, bigotry, and unchristianity which inspires all Sunday laws can be forced upon the attention of the people of the United States. I believe that these men will ultimately prove the instruments by which this survival of the union of church and state will be rooted out of every American commonwealth, and I will further say that if this should prove to be the case, they will have done more for the service of humanity and for the glory and welfare of our country than the greatest philanthropist, statesman, or soldier that ever lived. I am far from attaining to their standard of life, and I do not profess to decide controverted points of doctrine between them and other denominations, but I am proud to be associated with them in the humblest capacity in the fulfillment of this which I believe to be their mission. Men are rarer than are generally supposed, and these are men, and I am glad to be among them. Close quote. Only today, I received a letter from ex-Senator Tolley, stating that another eminent lawyer and prominent politician had volunteered to plead the cases of our brethren before the Supreme Court of Tennessee. Brethren, the whole world is soon to look at us. And what do you want them to see? We want them to see Christ. The attention of the world would have been turned to us long ago if we had reflected the life of Christ. There is really as much genuine religious liberty in the state of Tennessee as there is in any other part of the world. I know that from my own experience, for it was in an oak grove near Springville, Tennessee, where I first learned what religious liberty really is, and when that liberty came to my heart, I got a view of the third angel's message and its future such as I never had before. I recently witnessed the conversion of a soul, and one of the first things that that person gave utterance to after the first shout of victory was, Now I am not afraid of any persecuting laws that man can make. Brethren, let us, every one of us, get that same experience and have the spirit of religious liberty down deep in our hearts, and then we will be ready to suffer for Christ's sake. And then we will not only be ready, but we will be worthy to suffer. Now we are not worthy, but when the Lord puts his power in our heart, then we will be prepared to suffer for his name. Then the world will behold in us the representatives of the Lord, and all that will be saved will turn to the Lord. That's the end of this sermon.